Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Still to come this morning, a call-in for parents, mostly moms, who've taken many years out of the workforce. How did you successfully find your way back in after 6, 8, a dozen years staying home with your kids, or are you striking out? And why Slate's Josh Levine wants college basketball players to go on strike this afternoon rather than taking the court for March Madness Day 1, huh? We'll hear his argument. And later today, too, we will invite you to vote for the Brian Lehrer Show. That's right, vote for us in a non-sports bracket that another public radio station has going right now. Did you know that we are up against Studio 360 in round 2 of KPCC's Best Public Radio Show March Madness competition? We just beat only a game in round 1, but that was easy. To vote for the Brian Lehrer Show against Studio 360 in round 2, vote early and often. Go to our Twitter feed at Brian Lehrer, or go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show, and we'll tell you more about that later. But with us now is the renowned legal scholar and former advisor to President Obama, Cass Sunstein, on why we believe far-fetched conspiracy theories, including about Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. It's the title theme in a new collection of his writings called Conspiracy Theories and Other Dangerous Ideas. He teaches law and behavioral economics at Harvard, is married to UN Ambassador Samantha Power, and was in charge of President Obama's Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, the Regulation Czar, as he was known to some, which in fact is why Glenn Beck called him the most dangerous man in America. And there's a conspiracy theory, if ever I've heard one. Cass Sunstein, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
And so for people who don't know your work, you've written many super earnest policy books, like on FDR's Second Bill of Rights, one called Free Markets and Social Justice, and your book last year on the future of government. And many of those ideas are excerpted in your new book. But from that vantage point, how'd you get interested in conspiracy theories?
Well, I think it's very interesting to think about how information spreads and how people end up believing things that are true or false and how rumors get out there. It's a real problem for democracy sometimes when people end up not trusting their officials because of something that's false. And the existence of isolated social networks, which of course contribute to terrorism, seems extremely interesting to me. It helps explain why some nations are riven by civil war, why some nations aren't getting along very well with one another. And it also tells us something about how our own democratic processes maybe aren't working as well as they might.
Give me an example of how a conspiracy theory might lead to war.
Some countries, there are conspiracy theories about the United States being involved in terrible deeds that are false, and those can promote terrorist acts by getting young people, typically young men, very stirred up about how America needs to be stopped.
In fact, you wrote an op-ed as a Bloomberg View columnist the other day, published in Newsday and elsewhere, about Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 and conspiracy theories such as that maybe the U.S. kidnapped the plane. They used the word kidnapped. Somebody did, an Iranian lawmaker, in an effort to sabotage Iran's relationship with China.
Yes. So sometimes whenever anything goes wrong in the world, people are going to blame the United States. And this is typically unfair and inaccurate. And it is often an effort to stir up anti-American sentiments. That can be just part of political posturing. But in some cases, it's dangerous. And it's good for us to have friendly relations with other nations and for people not to do us harm. To correct conspiracy theories against us is sometimes helpful.
Conspiracy theories run in other directions, too. Another one that you mentioned with respect to Flight 370 is that North Korea hijacked the plane.
Yes, absolutely. So there's a great scene in Orwell's 1984 where there's a man named Goldstein who ends up being the kind of target of hatred. There's something called the 2 minutes hate, where everyone is very upset with Goldstein. And many nations, including sometimes people in our own, have their own Goldsteins and direct 2 minutes hate against someone. And conspiracy theories sometimes originate in either constructing or finding someone who can be subject to those 2 minutes.
And I guess you use the term conspiracy theory to mean something that's demonstrably false and that conjures a particular villain to be kind of a bogeyman. But is it too dismissive a term, conspiracy theories? I mean, sometimes there are conspiracies. Would you have believed me if I was stuck in traffic on the George Washington Bridge last fall and I called you from my car and said, I'll bet the governor's office is doing this to me and my neighbors on purpose? You probably would have said, wacko conspiracy theory, dude.
Yeah, I think the word conspiracy theory isn't itself pejorative. As you say, it's just descriptive. So there are true conspiracy theories. Watergate is the famous American example, and there are plenty of others. There's a great movie starring Mel Gibson, maybe very good movie, great maybe too much, but called Conspiracy Theory. It turns out to be true there. And real
He's
life
a
often,
film critic, no less. Go ahead.
And real life often replicates that. So it is fair to say conspiracy theories are sometimes true. In a free society, you want to allow people to raise questions, even if the questions are seem pretty out there. The concern from the standpoint of self-government and threats to peace, I think, is focused on the false conspiracy theories.
Cass Sunstein's new book, Conspiracy Theories and Other Dangerous Ideas, a collection of his various writings. And this seems to tie into a critique that you've had about the internet for more than a decade, that it tends to push us into politically closed communities, only hearing or mostly hearing from people like ourselves. And of course, we've talked about that idea many times on this show. A lot of people talk about it and the arguments for and against it. But is the propensity to believe a far-fetched conspiracy theory the fringy edge of that, or do you think it's increasing at the fringes because of communication on the internet?
Absolutely. So in terms of conspiracy theories and why they spread, there are three things I think to focus on, and you put a spotlight on the first, which is that often there's an isolated or self-segregated social network where people are either just talking to one another, or even if they're talking to lots of people, they're only listening to one another. And that's a breeding ground for the rise of conspiracy theories, some of which are harmless and some of which, as you say, are true, but some of which are dangerous, like the autism vaccination conspiracy theory, which is leading a lot of people not to vaccinate their children. That's dangerous. And isolated social networks, social media, that can be, have a lot of responsibility. If I can say just two other points, some people are inclined kind of just by nature to agree with conspiracy theories. So there are findings that if you think that Princess Diana is still alive, you're also more likely to think that there was some conspiracy to kill her. So mutually contradictory conspiracy theories people kind of believe. So there's a propensity for some people. And the third point, which is I think the most poignant, is that when there's been a terrible event, whether an economic crisis or a missing plane, if people are angry or afraid or even just extremely uncertain, they often seize on a conspiracy as a way of addressing that uncertainty. So those three things, the propensity, the social media, and the circumstance, are kind of breeding grounds for rise of conspiracy theories.
Listeners, any calls for Cass Sunstein this morning on the things we've been talking about so far, or really anything, if you've been a Cass Sunstein reader over the years or followed his career with the Obama administration as a so-called regulation czar, 212-433-WNYC, and we'll get into some of that, 212-433-9692. I'll be curious to know, and I don't know the answer to the question, of whether Cass Sunstein wrote any of the Obamacare regulations, but 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. Before we get to that stuff, the Boston Globe review of your book basically likes it and considers you a politically moderate pragmatist, both in your writing and your government career, but worries that you've got a streak of what the writer calls Orwell light, because you believe that the elites who know the real truth about things should manipulate us uneducated people into productive behaviors and away from conspiracy theories. through something you call libertarian paternalism. That was a key idea in your best-selling book, Nudge. And I presume by libertarian paternalism you don't mean Ron Paul.
No. The basic idea is that sometimes people do well with they have a GPS. So a GPS you can ignore. You can go your own way. So it's libertarian. But it's paternalistic in the sense that it tells you what it thinks is the route you should take to get where you want to go. We all can use a GPS once in a while, whether it's a bit of information about the nutritional content of food or whether it's a warning that you maybe shouldn't drive while you're texting, or if it's a rule that says, okay, you're going to be automatically in a retirement plan, but if you don't like it, you can get out. So the idea of libertarian paternalism, that's not the happiest phrase. The book that uses the idea is called Nudge. Maybe that's a little bit better. The idea that it's Orwell light strikes at least me, and of course I'm self-interested in this, and I want to defend the idea, but the Orwell light, it seems to me, is just a misunderstanding of the whole program. It's not Orwell light. It's not Orwellian to educate people about the risks associated with swimming when there's a lot of when there's a big undertow, or if there's an effort to tell people about the potential dangers associated with toys that have small parts.
So you're making it sound like simple public information campaigns. But a related term of yours for how to do this is cognition infiltration, which sounds like something Edward Snowden would want to blow the whistle on.
Yeah. So the idea of cognitive infiltration, and this is too provocative a term, the idea is suppose you have people in a foreign country who want to do us harm. Suppose they're, you know, not crazy people, but they're people who are being educated in crazy things. What's the source of that? It's because they're learning from people they trust, and the people they trust think that America is something horrible, and that's threatening American lives. The idea of cognitive infiltration, admittedly a provocative word, I'm not sure I'd use it again if I were rewriting, is that you correct the record either by getting people in that country talking to people who are gearing up to do terrible things, that what they think is true about the United States isn't, or people in America who are working with our government actually work with people in those countries to set the record straight, to say the United States isn't doing this, isn't responsible for that. So the word infiltration sounds a little more alarming than the basic idea, which is to correct the record when people are readying to act violently on the basis of misinformation.
Kate in Astoria, you're on WNYC with Cass Sunstein. Hi, Kate.
Hi. So actually, Professor Sunstein, I was at the University of Chicago Law School while you were teaching. I had David Strauss for Elements of Law, not you. But one of the things I was wondering was whether or not while you were, working with the Obama administration, basically the only over-the-counter rescue inhalers for asthma were taken off the market for some kind of CFC thing or something like that. And as a person with asthma, sometimes, you know, having access to a rescue inhaler can be the difference between life and death, or at least life in an emergency room visit. So I was just wondering, you know, I had heard at some point that maybe you had to use an inhaler, and how you kind of came to that decision.
And did you have anything to do with that decision?
Yes. Most of the key decisions were made in the Bush administration on this. I very much sympathize with the caller on this question. Taking away people's medicines is presumptively a bad thing to do. There's the Montreal Protocol, which says that things that have CFCs have to be regulated.
A polluting chemical.
Things that pollute.
Deplete the ozone layer, actually.
Exactly. We work pretty hard to give delays in terms of taking the drugs off the market so that there'd be CFC-free substitutes, as they're called. In terms of the over-the-counter one, that was a decision made in the Bush administration. It's been reported that I was in favor of reconsidering the Bush administration decision, that is to allow people to have over-the-counter drugs, and I can't deny the truth of those reports. That's a long way of saying I'm very sympathetic with what the caller suggested.
Glenn Beck called you the most dangerous man in America because you were President Obama's regulatory czar. And I guess in the conservative libertarian, maybe that's different from the paternalistic libertarian purist's worldview, all regulations are bad unless they have to do with abortion. So how much did you approach that job with the attitude of finding new regulations, like you went out to find regulations that would be good for the country?
My idea was twofold under the president's direction. First, you want to do what the law requires. And second, you want to make sure that the benefits justify the costs. So the fact is, in the first term of the Obama administration, there were fewer regulations than the first term of the Bush administration. And that attests to the caution that we had in a period of economic difficulty. What made the Obama administration's first term distinctive was not the number of rules, it was smaller, but the net benefits of rules, that is, the net benefits were in the tens of billions of dollars. And that's because there are rules that are making cars more fuel efficient, making appliances more energy efficient, making the air cleaner to breathe, making the food safer to eat. And those are both reducing costs big time and saving lives. So the idea of going out and finding new regulations, that's not something the president directed me to do, and I certainly wasn't thinking about that. If you could figure out a way to save lives or cut costs for small businesses and large businesses, help consumers, that's a pretty good idea.
Were you involved in developing regulations for Obamacare?
Yes, I was the head of the office at the time that the health regulations went through the office, involving such things as no annual or lifetime limits on expenditures, pre-existing conditions, you still get health insurance, and other first-round regulations.
But the mandate is also a regulation shutting down plans that don't have these various guarantees, which has left people without plans, is also a regulation. So it's not just rights. It's also, you know, stuff that's going to impact people as unintended consequences sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I distinguish between the law itself, which I had at most marginal involvement with, and the regulations that were issued pursuant to the law. The regulations that I mentioned, which are implementing the statute, have been widely approved. They're making sure that if you've got cancer, you can't be denied health insurance. If you have a long-term diabetes problem, you can't be cut off. And if you're 25 years old, you stay on your parents' plan. So all those went through with regulations, and not one has been struck down.
Harvard Law professor and former Obama regulatory official Cass Sunstein with us, a collection of his writings in a new book called Conspiracy Theories and Other Dangerous Ideas. And Phyllis in New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hello, Phyllis.
Hello. I was just wondering if conspiracy theories, which seem to abound, would not be or could not be helped by real news, hard news. And its dissemination properly.
Well, what is properly? People have to choose to consume it.
You make a great point. And one thing we've seen over the last decade and more is the decreased authority of intermediaries who do some filtering. So in 1965, there was a lot of filtering by the news media, and now with the social media, a lot of stuff gets out that's not filtered. That's, I think, mostly very good because it allows there's a lot more information, a lot more speakers. We have a much more robust marketplace of ideas.
And there's certainly a lot of things that the elite in the news media miss. And so I, for one, am not nostalgic for the old days of, you know, just three big broadcast networks when Walter Cronkite and David Brinkley were telling everybody the news and there wasn't any peer-to-peer really going on out there.
I completely agree with you. So it's on net a big gain for self-government and for more information, as you say, completely. But I think the caller is right to say that there's a downside, which is stuff gets out that isn't true. And if people believe it, it might be innocuous. But if they believe it and they're not vaccinating their children, then it's harmful.
Joshua in Chappaqua, you're on WNYC with Cass Sunstein. Hi, Joshua.
I think that the professor begs the question about what he terms conspiracy theories because there are evidently, as he acknowledges, conspiracies, whether it was the United States involvement in the 50s in Iran or later in Chile, or running toxic experiments on blacks in Tuskegee. There are elements when the government is doing things that are not acknowledged or acknowledged only, decades later.
Which is to say that there has been so much, malicious activity by government, including the United States government, that it feeds conspiracy theory mindsets because of actual history. Is that your main point?
The main point is that I think given the social bias toward commercialism by companies, that one has to maintain residual skepticism, and that conspiracy theories, whether correct or not, at least are an evidence of skepticism toward so-called accepted fact. And unless you can determine how to distinguish between what you think is a true conspiracy, or if you will, versus a manufactured conspiracy, I think it's wiser to veer towards skepticism.
There's a lot in that that is true and was put very eloquently. So in our society, to be skeptical is a legitimate part of citizenship, and skepticism entails not believing what you hear always, or not taking it on faith, certainly. So I don't disagree with the idea that some conspiracies actually happened and that some reports of conspiracies turn out to be true. What I'm focusing more on is the spread of false conspiracy theories, why that happens, what are the mechanisms by which it happens, when is it harmful? It can be harmful if it ends up breeding unjustified distrust as opposed to healthy democratic skepticism, and it can be harmful if it leads to either violence or a failure to take action that is necessary to protect health.
Joshua, great question. Thank you very much. I want to change the topic completely and reference something else in your book. Because, again, listeners, the new Cass Sunstein book, Conspiracy Theories and Other Dangerous Ideas, is a collection of essays of his over time. And Chapter 2 references your earlier book, FDR and the Second Bill of Rights. If there was going to be a Second Bill of Rights, what did FDR want to put in it, and why were you enthusiastic about it?
This, I think, is the greatest unknown speech in American history. And what Roosevelt said toward the end of his life, really, is that we've come to accept a Second Bill of Rights, which includes a right to education, a right to health care, a right to protection against the fears of old age, disability, and illness, a right to protection against monopolies at here and abroad, a right to decent employment, by which he didn't mean, by the way, that the government would guarantee everyone a job. But he meant that there would be efforts, economic efforts, to promote economic growth and employment. So what he was saying was that we have some cultural commitments now after his administration was drawing to a close, and those are commitments to make sure that people have an opportunity to have decent lives. And this seems to me kind of central to America's self-understanding. It doesn't mean that the Constitution should be formally amended. It doesn't mean that the original Bill of Rights is outmoded. But it does mean that our free market society has some commitments in it which are absolutely central to what makes America great.
We're going to have another author on in a few weeks who poses the idea of a Bill of Responsibilities to go with our Bill of Rights. Do you think that there is a tension in American policymaking? And, of course, there's the notion of the undeserving poor, which often tends to work on a policy level against enacting some of the rights you just enumerated. So is there a tension between rights and responsibilities in America that you think still needs to be hashed out?
Yes. Sometimes if you give people rights, they can actually promote responsibility. So in a free society, there's private property. And if you own things, then you're more likely to be responsible than if you don't. So some rights are actually inextricably intertwined with responsibility. But if you have a right to, let's say, economic protection against terrible conditions, it's fair to worry that that will breed irresponsibility on the part of the people who have those rights. And we need policies that manage that potential tension.
And I want to ask you about one other thing before you go. And you've written on so many things and had such an interesting and varied career and intellectual life that I could talk to you for about 9 hours today. But I saw your very recent, very balanced column about regulations and job loss, in which you say some regulations create jobs or don't cost hardly any, like the regulation of the oil industry and the plastics industry. You would think regulating a business is going to make them spend money on the regulations, and therefore they're going to have less money to hire. But that in the first 15 regulations on those industries actually have created a net few jobs, but that in the first 15 years of the Clean Air Act, it cost America 600,000 jobs. How do you know? And why would there be such a contrast?
You can find sectors of the economy where if the regulation kicks in, companies have to hire people to meet the regulatory requirements. So if they have to build environmental protection through, for example, new technologies, that'll hire people. On the other hand, as you say, if you impose regulatory costs, that can lead to a loss of jobs. And the study from MIT shows that the Clean Air Act led in the industries just to reduce hiring, and it measures areas that were subject to costly regulation compared to areas that aren't.
So did you revisit Clean Air Act regulations when you were in the White House regulatory catbird seat?
Absolutely. We took away some regulatory requirements, including some that involved air quality, because they weren't making any sense. And one thing that we ensured was that we studied the economic impact in terms of employment for every costly regulation to try to project whether we'd gain jobs or lose jobs. And if we thought we were going to lose jobs, then we'd try to figure out a way to make sure that didn't happen.
So how about the point where the two meet, that is the regulation on the energy industry, which you say could create jobs, and enforcement of the Clean Air Act, because now the Obama administration is using the Clean Air Act to impose regulations having to do with global warming?
Yes. Well, it would be very good to know whether the new global warming regulations are going to have an employment impact. And if so, what that is.
Do you feel like you do know? Because, of course, the Republican mantra is job-killing regulations.
Yeah, I think that idea of job-killing regulation, it has a kind of human goodness behind it, but it has a kind of political, mechanical quality in front of it. And I like the human goodness and not the mantra-like quality to it. It's an empirical question. So some of the global warming regulations, as we call them, for example, the standards for new coal-fired power plants, the EPA does not project significant job losses from that. And that's not just the EPA's projection. It's the projection of a wide range of people who've studied the issues. The Obama administration is going to propose rules governing existing power plants, and it's legitimate to try to catalog what the employment effects will be. And if they're bad, that's definitely something to be considered and to see if you can find a way to do it so you don't have those bad effects.
Cass Sunstein, Harvard Law professor, former Obama administration official. His new book is called Conspiracy Theories and Other Dangerous Ideas. By the way, you have to tell Mrs. Sunstein, U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power, to come back on the show. Her book interview for A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, was one of my favorite ever on the show. So I look forward to seeing her back in that chair one day.
That's great. She's pretty busy these days, but I'm sure she'd be happy to be back when the world gets a little simpler.
And Cass Sunstein, well, so we have a long time to wait, in other words. Cass Sunstein, thanks a lot.
Thank you.